tonight on Arena. From 4,000 entries down to just one writer, we announce the winner of this year's RTE Short Story Competition. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Wow, is there a palpable sense of excitement here in Studio One or not? As the 10 finalists in the RTE Short Story Competition await the announcement of the third, second and first prizes. 4,000 entries, as I said, have been whittled down to 10 finalists, and we will be announcing the results of this year's competition coming up towards 8 p.m. All of the stories are available to read right now on rte.ie/culture, and you can listen to a story from the shortlist on air every night from tonight, Friday, through until Friday the 9th of October, and that takes place at 11:20. It's part of Late Date on RTE Radio 1, and the stories, I've listened to all of them. They're read by some of our finest actors. Really are a treat over the next 10 nights on Late Date. In the meantime, we'll be talking to the people who decided the results, judges Vincent Woods, Madeleine Keane and Daniel McLaughlin. But before we get into the specifics of the RTE Awards, let's take a deep dive into the short story form in general. What makes a good short story great? And what, for my next two guests, are some of the must-read great short stories? Joining me from Athlone, Nuala O'Connor, and writer Thomas Morris, who both have written short stories and written about writing a short story as well. Tom, let me start with you. People often set this idea of the short story versus the novel, a kind of conflict. Is that even a fair fight? You know, which of your children do you like best? Which do you like best, apples or oranges?
I think it so often comes down to personal preference. And I think it probably does the short story form a disservice to be constantly comparing it to the novel. I think they can do such different things. But I'm also kind of wary of being prescriptive about what a short story does. I think so often writers are very keen to say a short story does this, whereas a novel does that. And quite often they're just describing their own writing.
So is that what you think of Frank O'Connor's statements? Clearly one of the great exponents of the short form. He said at one stage, the novel assuages loneliness while the short story confronts loneliness. That sounds like a pretty good analysis to me.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful analysis. And that comes from his indispensable kind of a book-length essay on the form called The Lonely Voice, where that's his main argument, really, is that the short story is a place for kind of lonely voices to congregate. But I think for a long time, that was kind of the only theory we had for the short story, and that was the one that was trotted out every time people spoke about the short story. Said, it's about a lonely voice, about loneliness. And whereas some of my favourite short stories are about loneliness, I think it's also a space for it to be so much more, you know, a space to explore joy and a space to explore love and excitement and people coming together. It's not just about people being alone and looking out the window feeling sad.
And even that list, Nuala, that Tom gives us there, you know, joy, love, loneliness, whatever, the gamut of emotions, they're really, even though you're talking about a short form, you have to get a payoff if you're going to read a short story, even though the investment of time is not as great as that you might have to give to a novel.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the first thing to say is that they are their own art. They're not a big poem and they're not a small novel. And just because they're small doesn't mean they're minor. Basically, I suppose a short story is a small slice of time where things are going wrong for someone. So we're meeting the characters now because something has or is about to change for them. They're in trouble or it's about to begin. So things are going wrong, but they may yet go right. So there is room for all of that. You know, joy and love and, you know, disaster as well. It's a very malleable form. Mm. It's elusive. It's difficult to pin down. You know, a lot goes into a short story and something very condensed and rich comes out. But they're so diverse, as Tom said. Like, it's very hard to actually say, you know, oh, this is what constitutes a short story, or that is, you know, because they're so different.
Again, there's something you sent us in, some ideas around the whole idea of short fiction. And I loved this statement that you made at the end of the first paragraph you wrote to us, in fact. Raise questions and delay their answers. That's great advice.
that's what you want to do. You want to raise a question early in the story, I suppose, and then let your reader follow like a line of questions until they get to the sort of maybe the aha moment that they're waiting for. They may never get that moment, because one of the beauties of short stories is they can be, you can leave the reader anywhere. So you can have, an ending like a clicking box, as Yeats might have had it for poetry. It stands for fiction as well. But you can also have this lovely ambivalence in short stories where you end it and the reader doesn't know what happens next. And sometimes I do think that people come to read short stories and they really want to be reading a novel. So they want a novel-y sort of experience, yeah. But it's a very different thing. Reading stories requires a sort of a very pure concentration. It's a deep and committed immersion. Yeah. It's not like the novel. You don't go back. It's not a comfort blanket. It's a one swallow experience.
Yeah, funny you should say that, because as I was listening, I said that I listened to all of the short stories over the past few days. But they're not, often when you're listening to a novel, you can kind of have it on in the background. You can be doing two or three other things at the same time. When with these short stories, I had to sit for the 15 minutes and listen to them. I couldn't be doing something else, because I suppose it's the way that the thing has been shortened down. But I'm interested there that you say you can actually not give the answer at all. Is that because of the short form? Like if you read a whole novel and you're at the end of it going, now you're not going to tell me what happened after 450 pages or a long film. You're going to leave me hanging like that. You can do that in a short story and it's not as irritating.
I don't know. I think readers come at things differently. I know Sebastian Barry quite likes these open endings to his novels as well. I don't think we need to be spoon feeding the reader. There's a thing that we have in fiction, and they're productive gaps, and that's where the reader does work. And perhaps with the short story, the reader has to do more work. And maybe that's why sometimes readers say they don't get short fiction somehow. So maybe we need to train readers to understand the reading experience involved.
You had a great thing in an article that you wrote, actually, writing about the short story, Tom. And it comes from George Saunders, rather, the author of Lincoln in the Bardo, the novel Lincoln in the Bardo, who's best known as a short story writer. He had a great idea of what you're doing when you write the story. Just give us his argument and what he imagined, or he advises people to imagine.
Oh, well, I should say the first thing, if you are wanting to write short stories, you should read George Saunders' interviews, because in every interview he throws up an incredible analogy for what we're doing in short stories. So there's about 112 things I could say now, but I think of the thing that comes back to me often is he talks about the short story as a place of persuasion. And he said to imagine that the reader is a friend who's going to leave town. And as a writer, you've got at your disposal any tool that you want to pick in order to persuade them to stay. Mm. And you can use humor, you can use seriousness, you can use charm, but basically you can do anything just to keep them there. And I remember hearing that at the time and feeling kind of made free as a writer, and that I didn't have to come and be kind of my serious literary Tom coming here, but you can use anything that's at your resource as a person.
Yeah, that is a very open-ended idea, isn't it, really, Nuala, that we have there. This is, your friend's getting on a train and you want to stop them leaving town. Your reader's about to just close the book and go away. You have to stop them all the time. That's quite an ask from a writer, Nuala, really, isn't it?
It is. He does write brilliantly about short fiction, but also his collection, The 10th of December, is one that I'd recommend to all aspiring short story writers, just to see how strange and surreal the form can be, and it supports that really well. And that's why it's such a, it is such a bendy form that you can actually do anything. And he has that brilliant sort of strangeness that he brings in, a lot of sciencey stuff. And I know nothing about science, but I find his stories really compelling. And I'm actually quite fond of a lot of American writers, like Flannery O'Connor would be one of my heroines. I just love the way, again, she can use humor and wit, but marry it with violence and darkness, and just she entwines it all so deftly, and her dialogue is sublime. Anybody who feels that they're not great at writing dialogue, read some Flannery O'Connor and you will see how to do it just brilliantly.
And sometimes it's a little hook into the idea behind a short story that just gets you from the outset. You have a story called Zoo by Jeff Landon.
Yeah.
It's the point of view here that immediately you go, What a brilliant way to start. Or what a brilliant vision to have for a story.
Yeah, what I love about Jeff Landon's zoo, and an American writer friend of mine, Meg Pockris, introduced me to Jeff Landon, and he's published with a really tiny publisher in the States called Matter Press. And this story, it's playful and it's serious. It's about animal rights, but it's also about displacement and home. And it's told in the voice of a gorilla, which might put people off initially. But actually, when you read it, you can see that this story is sort of living proof that a story can be about anything, be told in any voice, have a light tone, but be about an issue and be very successful. And it's less than 1,000 words long.
I know, 900. I think you gave us a word count actually at the end of it, 900 and whatever it is.
902 or something.
902 words. Will you read the opening, just the opening paragraph, which I think really gives a sense of what you're talking about, how you know, don't let your friend leave town. You're not going to leave town if you hear a gorilla speaking to you like this.
I'll read the first paragraph. I have to say the story gets better and better as it goes on, but here's the first paragraph anyway. Zoo, Jeff Landon. Home. We're a family, but the only thing that binds us now is blood. We are Western Lowland gorillas, displaced in the Virginia Beach Zoo, but no complaints. Our space is open and rich with what we need, water for bathing, trees to climb, and a cave to hide in when the world gets too large. The food is great if you like roots and celery, and I sure do. We have names, Cindy, Doogie, Zip and Jude. I am Jude. Tourists call out to me, "Hey Jude, don't let me down." In sign language, I tell them, "I will kill you." Our zoo is failing. Last month, the prairie dogs were relocated a few miles up the road to Norfolk, to the good zoo, the giraffe zoo.
Wow. I don't know how many sentences are in that first paragraph, but look at how many twists and turns that we got. It is an extraordinary story. And as you say, it gets better and better as it goes on.
It does. Nuala. And you can read it online, actually.
Yeah, Zoo by Jeff Landon. So that's one of your recommendations. What about you, Tom, if you were, you know, narrowing down short stories that kind of have that immediately grasp you and hold you by the throat quality, where would you send us?
Well, one of the things that struck me there with the story that Nuala was reading, and I've never heard about all story before, so thanks for recommendation, is that so often what I'm drawn to is a kind of an emotional realism or a psychological realism. So the story itself doesn't need to kind of be realistic per se, and then I'm willing to follow, you know, 5,000 words of a talking animal. but I think one contemporary Irish writer who's wonderful at the surreal and the kind of what exactly is going on here is the writer Nicole Flattery.
Yeah.
And she published a story collection in Sting and Fly called Show Them a Good Time last year. And the title story from that collection, Show Them a Good Time, is wonderful. It's about a young woman who's returned home to Ireland from the States, and she'd moved back in with her parents, and something has happened in America. We're not quite sure what, but some kind of trauma. And she's returned, she's feeling lost, and she's looking for work. And she ends up taking this kind of job scheme placement at a petrol garage. The twist being, it's not a real garage. There's no real petrol being sold. It's just a kind of a government scheme to get people back into work. Yeah. And all these passengers are turning up, looking for fuel, but they can't offer it. And it's just a surreal twist. And
the entire collection, actually, lots of the stories kind of go off in directions you're not expecting at a moment that you're not expecting it. I'm looking again at something you said for us, Nuala. Pluck and hoard new words wherever you find them. And you preceded that sentence with use your thesaurus. And I thought, I would have said, you know, pick and keep. But you have pluck and hoard new words wherever you find them. Did you use your thesaurus?
Probably. I use it every day, actually. I always have it open, a tab of my thesaurus open on my screen. I just think that, like, I edit a flash fiction magazine. Flash fiction are tiny short stories. And the stories that come in to us for each issue, the ones that really grab me are always the ones that are doing interesting things with language. And that language can be plain or it can be adorned. It doesn't matter. It's down to personal style. But if I can tell that a writer is using language judiciously, that they're thinking about it.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, you know, straining for each word, but that language means something to them, means a lot to them. I love that in fiction.
All right, I'll let you give me one more story. No big, long description. What's the story the second story I should read from you, Nuala O'Connor?
Good Country People by Flannery O'Connor.
Flannery O'Connor, Good Country People. And what are you saying, Tom?
I'm going to say No Pain Whatsoever by Richard Yates.
Richard Yates, No Pain Whatsoever. One final question to you, Noel O'Connor. When was it, 2003? Do you remember this night? You won this competition,
I do,
didn't you?
Yeah, absolute shock. I mean, people say when they win a prize, they're in shock, and you think, what, you were in for it? How could you be surprised? But I was absolutely stunned. Yeah, it was wonderful, a real shot in the arm, and, you know, I was delighted, and it gave me confidence. And I think that's what these prizes do. They give you confidence to move forward and maybe work harder at your craft and send your stuff out to bigger and better places, or, you know, the magazines that you think will never publish you, and then you end up in them because, you know.
Well, listen, congratulations on 2003, belated though it may be. I hope I may be shocking some people later on in the programme when we call them and when we speak to them. We'll be speaking to some of the shortlisted writers. We'll be hearing from the stories. And, of course, coming towards 8 o'clock, we'll be talking to the winners or the winner of this year's competition. And welcome back to this special arena and the announcement of the winners of this year's RTE Short Story Competition. 4,000 entries, a short list of 10, all to be broadcast live on RTE Radio 1, read by some of our finest acting talent. And that begins tonight at 11:20 on Late Date. You can watch us from now, the RTE Short Story Competition, on rte.ie/culture and rte.ie/arena. With me in studio were two of the trio who made the most difficult of the choices. The judges here in Dublin, writer and broadcaster Vincent Woods and Madeline Keane, literary editor of the Irish Independent, and in our Cork studio, Danielle McLaughlin. Now, we've been speaking about the shortlist for quite a while now. As I said, all of them available to read on rte.ie/culture, and you can listen nightly on Late Date. But let us list in alphabetical order according to title. So take nothing from the order of the reading of this list. It's the title by alphabet. That's how we were going to list all 10 of them. Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees by Julie Cruikshank. Everything Will Be Recorded by Sean Mackle. Flower Wild by Shane Tivnan. Guinness and Coke by Lachlan McKenna. Hands a Downpour by Angus Murray. Nyadu by Kerry Garfield. Kissing Booth by Alan Walsh. Tactics by Andrew Maguire. The Brow of the Hill by Adele Maloney. And The Ship on the Strand by Catherine Duffy. Those are the 10 shortlisted stories. And as I said, two of the judges with me in Dublin, Vincent Woods, Madeline Keane, Danielle McLaughlin in our Cork studio. Vincent, I listened to all 10 short stories. Was it difficult to get down to the 10, as your job must have been, to get to the winner?
It was, of course. It was, you know, the standard was very high. But I think we reached consensus fairly quickly. Right. And that's always a relief when you have three people on a judging panel and you meet for the first time and you discover that actually you're fairly close.
That's,
you
know, not so
there was
bad.
A little bit of ground to cover, but we got there with relative ease. I mean, it was very interesting, Sean, to look at the themes that came in. You know, almost all of the stories were set in Ireland. And I've said this before, there was almost this palpable sense of unease of a kind running through a lot of the stories.
Do you think that might be related to the fact that obviously a lot of these stories were written during the pandemic?
I can only assume that. I mean, in a way, we, you know, there's only one story that almost directly reflects these pandemic times, and that's in a really unexpected and subversive way. That's Kissing Booth. But we got a lot of darkness in there. You know, secrets, lies, child abuse, family conflict, death, alcohol abuse, dementia, betrayal, but you know, glints of humour as well, and that was very welcome. They weren't completely without humour.
Yeah, there's humour there for sure.
But definitely some sense of kind of unease, insecurity, the world at odds with itself, people in a kind of limbo.
Yeah, that's often the case though, Madeline, isn't it? That things aren't addressed directly, but they kind of maybe inform the tone and the themes that writers come to.
Absolutely. And I was very touched by the sadness I could feel emanating off all those pages very, very strongly. That said, I don't want to cast a depressing note, because through so many of them, our indomitable grit and humour shone through. And that was very heartening too, to see that while dealing with very difficult subjects, there was still, you know, that slant, that edge, that courage, which we've all well, most of us have shown this year, I think.
And I think you noticed family as a theme that came back again and again.
Family was very strong in a lot of the stories, and particularly, and a subject I'm fascinated by, the parent-child relationship. Mm. And obviously, the more dysfunctional it gets, the more interesting I find it.
That's a short story.
As I'm sure a lot of people do. So, yes, it was interesting how much parenting there was, wasn't it?
Mm. We'll come to the specifics of some of them in a moment, but let me speak to Danielle as well at this point, Danielle McLaughlin in our Cork studio. A record number of entries this year, Danielle, 4,000. Do you think that may have been, in fact, where the pandemic started to feed in, or were there other factors that might have encouraged writers to give it a go?
Well, I think it's absolutely fantastic to see so many people embracing writing as something for them and not just thinking of writing as something that other people do. I think everybody has stories to tell, and it was wonderful to see literally thousands of stories making that crucially important journey from inside a writer's head out to the world, because there's writing of a story and then there's the next step, the offering of that story to the world. So I think a competition deadline is a very good incentive to take that next step.
And again, we're going to play some clips, hopefully from all of the stories. Take no, there is nothing in the order in which we're playing it. We just have them in themes and collections together that make it easy for us to get our way through the 10 stories. And I'm starting with that theme of family, and I'm starting with the complex parent-child relationship. In this case, a father of son at the centre of Guinness and Coke by Lachlan McKenna, Madeline.
Yes, I adored this story. There was something in it that was very tragic, it was very tender, and there was great truth in it. A boy goes off with his father for the weekend. The father seems to have custody of the child every weekend. And to say it is chaotic is putting it mildly. But it was an incredible story, really wonderfully wrought as well, wonderfully crafted.
Right, well, let's listen to a little section here read by Ina Hardwick, Guinness and Coke by Lachlan McKenna. I should say, they're setting off on their journey at this point in the story.
We put a tenner in the car and a fiver in the red backup can. He lets me fill them both. We get snacks and surprise, which usually meant I'd pick up a mint crisp bar or a packet of snacks as a post-breakfast roll treat. Some nights, I was tucked up snuggly under the work jackets, fleeces and high-vis vests, anything we could get our hands on to create a makeshift blanket. I'd toss in my seat looking for a comfortable position and knock my foot against one of the many milk bottles or 7-Up bottles below, creating a dull plastic thud.
There we go. Ina Hardwick reading from Guinness and Coke story by Lachlan McKenna, one of the 10 shortlisted stories for this year's RTE Short Story Competition. Let's go to one of the writers that is also on that shortlist, Julie Cruikshank. Her story is called Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees. And again, we're dealing with a family dynamic here. Maybe you could tell us, Julie, what the family dynamic is.
Well, it's basically, I suppose, a story of a complex family in which there is the traditional mum, dad, two children, and then a sister who has a child, and nobody's really sure who the child's father. And I suppose it's the relationship really between the two sisters and how that's played out in some ways between the children also, but also between the kind of crisscross relationships between the aunt and the nephew.
Yeah, and it's the aunt who is minding the young boy, Sam. She's the narrator of the story here. But I believe there's a tree in the Phoenix Park, which was the initial inspiration, an actual tree that was your inspiration here.
Yeah, there's a tree. I'm sure many parents of young children will know this tree. It's near the Interpretive Centre in the Phoenix Park. And when my boys were very young, I used to take them there all the time, and it's a huge tree with a kind of canopy that encloses the space. So there's a feeling that you can go inside the tree, and it's got these massive trunks, and the kids just love climbing all over them. And I love that tree, and I suppose it was always, there is something creepy a little bit about that when it comes to a certain time of day.
And probably inevitable that it was going to make its way into your writing at some stage. Well, listen, congratulations on the shortlisting at any rate, Julie, and best
Thank
of luck
you.
as the results are announced later on. And let's listen
Thank
to
you.
A clip from Beneath the Trees by Julie Cruikshank. And here the little boy, Sam, has had a toilet accident and his aunt has brought him to the toilet to wash his hands. Cathy Belton is the reader.
The tap runs hotter, than comfortable. But she keeps his hands steady, rubs soap in between his fingers, tries to get in under his nails. The shrieking hurts her ears. Stop whinging, Sam. The water needs to be hot. It's the kick in the shins that finally releases her grip. Sam, that is not funny. Mummy will be very cross. And he bolts, the door banging behind him.
There you go. Cathy Belton reading from Julie Cruikshank's story, Beneath the Trees, Where Nobody Sees, one of the 10 shortlisted stories. We have a special programme for you this evening here in Arena, the RTE Short Story Competition. We're going through the 10 shortlisted stories and we'll be announcing the winner close to 8 o'clock. Danielle, there's a kind of a darkness in Julie's story, in the domestic drama that plays out in front of her eyes. But you, again, I was saying this thing about you have to sit down and listen. You have to be vigilant to catch it.
It's a beautifully layered and nuanced story, and it starts out by almost lulling the listener into a sense of everyday domesticity, and that is then peeled back very skillfully to reveal something darker. So wonderful layers and nuance going on in the story.
All right, let's move on then to number 3 of 10, Hands a Downpour by Angus Murray. And here it's read, the main character here is Francis Mulcahy, and the story is read by Liam Kearney.
The rain cascades from the rumbling sky in wild kamikaze drops, which splatter and splash off the sopping pavement, where Francis Mulcahy stands hazily, as if he himself is not a part of this scene, as if, covered by a protective layer, a soft, blurred, almost translucent presence, arms hanging limply by his side, hood down, staring at the cracked and peeling paint on the door of number 17 Lennox Street. Staring so hard that you'd swear he was trying to hypnotise the latch into giving.
That's a section there from Hands a Downpour, story by Angus Murray, read by Liam Kearney, and one of the 10 on the RTE Short Story Competition shortlist. Vincent Woods, one of the judges with me in studio here, along with Madeline Keane, Daniel McLaughlin in Cork. There's a Mike McCormick touch to this, if essentially, Vincent. Solo Bones. It's one long sentence.
One long sentence. And it's a really intriguing story. It's beautifully written. From the word go, I thought, here's something unusual, really accomplished. The sense of the downpour, of the rain coming down, is so palpable right through. But again, there's this slightly mysterious backstory, slightly ghostly presence in a way within a house, within and outside a house, a sense of a non-resolved past, this story really, really stays with you.
Yeah,
it's a powerful piece of radio as well.
And Madeline, then, this whole idea of style was there also in a story by Andrew Maguire called Tactics, written in the future tense.
Yes, this was a very interesting way of writing. Mm. This concerns a young Polish guy who is going to play pool in a shebeen with a group of older Irish men. And it was cast in the future tense, which is a very unusual and must be a very difficult way to write. I mean, he's obviously, you know, he was in command of his work because...
Well, let's ask the man himself how difficult it is to write in the future tense. Andrew Maguire joins us on the line, the writer of the short story Tactics. Two questions. Why did you choose the future tense, Andrew? And how difficult was it to follow through on that choice?
Hi, Sean. I suppose there's sort of two things I could say about the way in the writing of the story. The setting and a lot of the backdrop and the characters of the story is something I'd intended and planned to write about for a long time.
And this is the idea of a group of people, a group of men playing snooker in this shebeen, wherever it is.
Yeah, and I was sort of trying to capture the sort of intensity and regularity of that type of setting. And the idea of writing it in the future tense sort of came after I'd written the first draft in the present tense, and it sort of occurred to me during the day, and I sort of just knew straight away that it would be the way to go. I knew that it would sort of capture a bit of the intensity I was looking for in it.
So you had a sense when you were finished, the future tense works. Mm-hmm. Now I'm finished with the story.
Well, sort of, even before it even got to the page with it, I sort of knew that it would add something that I was looking for, and hopefully it worked.
Okay, well, listen, congratulations on the shortlisting. That's Andrew Maguire there, the writer of Tactics. Let's listen to a section from the story called Tactics. And Sean is the barman here, and Gigsy and Wojciech are the two snooker players. And the reader is... I'll come back to the reader in a second.
Sean will let out a short bark of laughter from behind the bar. A single nervous exhale of air before asking, "You're hardly serious?" And Gigsy will say, "I am." And Wojciech will say, with a confidence no one will have expected, "I'll play for as much as you like." And there'll be a divide in the Shebeen that has never existed before.
And I want to find out what that divide is, don't I? It's amazing how you can just be hooked in like that. Like Nazi Rybarczyk was the reader there of Tactics by Andrew Maguire. Andrew speaking to us on the phone just before that. We'll move on to a story now called The Kissing Booth. And this is the one that speaks, I suppose, Danielle, directly to the pandemic in some ways. But this is also the one that struck me as perhaps the one that has the quirkiest sense of humour.
Yes, this is a playful and subversive treatment of a very contemporary predicament. The story takes the idea of virus, of contagion, and turns it on its head. And it takes vocabulary that we've become very familiar with over these past few months, infection, positives, negatives, and puts that vocabulary to work in a way that's entertaining and fun.
Yeah, indeed. The idea here is that rather than socially distance yourself, you're trying desperately to be positive. So the author here, or the narrator here, has found somebody who can kiss her and therefore make her positive. And this is Bláthnaid McGowan reading from Kissing Booth.
I dredged up this guy's ad on the dark web. He said he was selling infections out of the back of a supermarket after hours, and I was one of the blessed few to answer before he deleted it 20 minutes later. Positives already jealously hoard infection within their circles. We've got like a week before these deals stop happening.
There we go. Bláthnaid McGowan reading Kissing Booth by Alan Walsh. And Alan, in fact, is on the line now as well. Were you looking for a way, Alan, really to turn? Because obviously there was a lot of down feeling, a lot of sadness, a lot of negativity, clearly around COVID-19 and the pandemic. Were you trying to find a humorous way out of that? Or what was your idea in the story?
Yeah, well, that was it. You know, I suppose I spent the summer writing a couple of stories, and a lot of them tended to be writing toward like a utopia or some kind of positive way, positive future that might possibly happen, and finding odd ways to do that. And certainly this was one where I was trying to find a way to write about maybe a next step, I suppose, which was a kind of upbeat rather than looking at everything being so downcast, because it was been a pretty dire time, I think, for everyone.
And Bláthnaid McGowan's reading of it, there are sections of it when it goes very Cork indeed. Was it? is the Cork aspect of things important for you?
No, I'm from Wicklow, so I'm fascinated to hear what it's going to be like. Actually, yeah.
I loved the Cork aspect to it. Maybe I was making that up in my own head. Well, listen, congratulations to you also, Alan, on your shortlisting, and we'll see how things go later on, because obviously three of the ten have to be in that third place, second place and first place that we will be announcing later on, getting their 1,000, 2,000 and 3,000 euro. Of course, everybody who is shortlisted on the tonight's competition gets 250 euro for the story, and that broadcast, you've been sampling just some of the quality of the nature of the writing that we're getting. It is beautiful. And I think, Vincent, it is important that these stories are written for radio. It's an aspect of them that maybe adds an extra layer, does it?
Absolutely. And, you know, in reading them, you're reading them consciously imagining how they'll sound on radio. And it does alter the way you read. And it was fascinating then as well when we got the recordings and in a way weighed them up against what we had imagined in our own minds. Because you do imagine a voice, you imagine a whole world that comes to life in a broadcast. And it's in a way a slightly different form. I think to write a really good short story for radio is different to writing a really good short story for the page.
And it slightly changed our minds, didn't it? When we did then hear them recorded. And there was quite a space between you know, all the reading of them and then listening to them.
Well, that sets us up very nicely for our next story, which, because we're talking about translating from the page there to the radio. Yeah. This next story, a great conceit at the heart of it, Madeline, The Ship on the Strand by Catherine Duffy.
Yeah, fascinating. It's set on an unnamed Spanish island, and our enigmatic narrator, who I just loved, she is translating the work of a dead writer who has expressly forbidden that his work be translated. And it's a story within a story. It's a ghost story. The imagery is wonderful. There's a feathered hat I cannot get out of my head. It is firmly lodged there.
Haunted by a hat.
Yes. There's a touch of it. Let's listen to a clip that mentions our hat, where we'll hear about the aforementioned hat. And the narrator is just discovering this, in fact, and it's something that will literally haunt her for the rest of the story. Jane Brennan is the reader.
The translator is surprised to find a man's hat on the top shelf of the wardrobe. She's standing on a chair, scrabbling for her sun hat, which she tossed up here with a neat frisbee throw when she was unpacking on the first evening. Her own hat is a rather romantic straw number trimmed with a pale green ribbon. Maybe a bit young for her now, but who's here to judge? She's free to wear what she likes. This other hat is an old-fashioned dark brown trilby with a little green feather in its band. Too warm for this climate. It must belong to whoever had this room before her. A forgetful old gent from some northern provincial town, maybe. She imagines him tipping this hat with endearing formality to the ladies he passed on his evening promenade by the sea.
Jane Brennan there, reading from The Ship on the Strand by Catherine Duffy. And that's one of the 10 shortlisted stories. Danielle, that was the one that struck me. I think it was Madeline who said earlier on, most of the stories are set in Ireland. That's the one that takes us out of Ireland. And I thought there was a European feel to it. You know, Milan Kundera came to my mind, Kafka, there's a European quality in the story, I thought.
Yeah, the Spanish island is wonderfully created by the writer. The whole story is wonderfully woven, the ghost story element, and it's dark and entertaining. And it's also a story that plays with very interesting questions around the act of translation.
Yeah. And now, Tosul or Ta Ahas Morum are off fresh and go will scale one or on Garlista. I will ask Gaelic, August Shin on Skill Nyadu Le Kerry Garfield. And Kerry is on the phone right now. Cogardio, Sir and Gaed Dulcius, Kerry. Scriven to Imerla August Askwelega?
Shin, Sinead, Sean, yeah, and Dalrod.
And is there a. Did the stories suggest themselves? Do you know from the outset this is Askwelega, this one is Imerla? Is that very clear from the very beginning of the story to you?
Well, it's hard to say now, Sean, because I've only written three stories, and thus far two have been in Irish, and I just wrote an English one over the summer. Yeah.
And did you grow up with Irish, Kerry, or where did the Irish come from?
No, I moved to Inishman, the middle of the Aran Islands, and I stayed with a lady by the name of Maura Faugheen, who taught me all the Irish I know.
Right. And what brought you, I've never, going up a little rabbit hole, down a little rabbit hole here, what brought you to the Aran Islands?
I was living in America and I was looking after a Finnish family and started picking up Finnish very quickly and decided that why would I bother doing that when I really want to speak Irish? So I moved home from San Francisco to the Aran Islands. Quite a change.
What a great reason to move to Inishmeann. So maybe give us the kind of the setup here for Nyadu and the young boy Danny, isn't it? Who we're watching throughout this story, Kerry.
Yeah, Danny finds a little dead bird in the shed, and he's a little boy who is confined to home. He's convalescing, and it's not really clear, you know, what exactly is going on with him. But he's fascinated by this little bird, and kind of the thought of what the outside world that lies beyond.
All right. Well, ishnishnishle gyota biog on scale bridge ni nyachtan atá eglev an sha. Nyadu on scale, agus Kerry Garfield a scríobh on scale seo.
Dí is gan mál merigach a osclítar doras an chró. Tá lealáv Danny sínte i dro an wála agus an cianaile ectarint ar wúrlán a dyrish. Gach rion dinierach le fecaol ar aí an gásúr vig. Dioriní alas ag silanuas an wáis. Da harantele Dr. Dúlán Inchi on Tandairish, agus Nochtor Valach Rither.
Gahaling on Goelige Jas Shin, a Clishtal, a Vrigini Nacton, a Viaglev on Shin, Vrigini Nacton reading the story Nyadu from Kerry Garfield, who moved to the Aran Islands because you wanted to learn Irish instead of Finnish. That's the best reason I've ever heard to go there. What would Irish stories, it's just a while, I think, Vincent, from there's been an Irish. A story Os Gaeilge shortlisted.
It is, and it was wonderful to find this story here among the others. It's a beautiful story. There were quite a few, and again, I think, you know, a high standard, but this really stood out, and it's a beautiful, tender story of family dynamics, of a boy who's ill, who might have a disability, whose reach for freedom, in a way, is represented through this bird, this dead bird, and the drawing of the relationship between him and his dad and his mother, beautiful. And between the parents is really, really powerful. It's a gorgeous story.
It really is lovely. Danielle in Cork, let's not leave you out of the discussion. Danielle McLaughlin, most of the stories, Danielle, have a contemporary setting. The Brow on the Hill, or The Brow of the Hill, I beg your pardon, by Adele Maloney. This has a post-famine setting.
Yes, and one of the joys of a good short story is the way it can transport us so completely to a different place or time. And The Brow of the Hill takes us to a snowy Sunday morning in December 1886 on the feast of the hermit Saint Sabas. And it's a morning on which life and death intermingled. The setting is magnificently rendered. The images are striking. It's like stepping inside a painting. And the story is told in language that puts me in mind of a fable. It's very beautiful.
Yeah, and let's listen to a clip, in fact. And at this point in time, the father of the family, Mr. Nugent, is at Mass. And there's a real sense of urgency when this scene happens. And as you said, Danielle, there's a sense of a painting about it, a drama about it. Dervla Crotty is the reader of this section from The Brow of the Hill by Catherine Duffy.
Dolly, in her terror and confusion, made the sign of the cross and said, "Pater Noster, qui es in celis? Please excuse me, Father, but Mr. Nugent is needed desperately at home, and you after him, please, Father." And everybody in the church sucked in their breath as one. But Father Mulcahy just hastily blessed the air in the direction of my father and said, "Hugh, go, for the love of God." And my father raced out of the church, and he ran back up the hill, not caring now about his Sunday shoes. And he burst through the kitchen and into the hall to find Mrs. Conroy, the midwife, weeping bitterly on the stairs.
Dervla Crotty reading there from The Brow of the Hill. And Adele Maloney, sorry, I gave the wrong author there. Adele Maloney is the writer of that story, The Brow of the Hill. Vincent, another story is an interesting idea comes from the writer Shane Tivenin. He's imagined a testimony of Violet Gibson, the Irish woman who tried to assassinate Mussolini. I've heard about three or four things about her recently. It's amazing how an idea comes into the ether like that.
Absolutely. In the last 5 years, you've had Lisa O'Neill write a song. Barry Dowdle made a film with Alwyn Ware playing Violet Gibson. There are a few plays, this biography and a really fine radio documentary. So suddenly Violet Gibson has been brought back into history. Fascinating story. She was the daughter of Lord Ashburn, born in Merrion Square, would have known the wilds. Mm. And she's another, like Countess Markowitz, another of these aristocratic rebels. But it's not quite clear. She had a pot shot at Mussolini in Rome in March 1926.
Took the nose off him.
It almost took the nose off him. She escaped a lynching. And because of her family influence, she was spared. She came back to England and spent the rest of her life in a famous psychiatric hospital in Northampton, mental hospital, where the story is set. An interesting detail of that family life that I've only recently discovered was that her brother William learned Irish in Trinity College and was president of the Gaelic League in London. So, I mean, a fascinating family.
Mixture of families.
And this story is fascinating in its exploration of the interior life of the woman. You know, it's not presenting her as a hero who tried to bring down the great dictator. It's much more subtle and complex.
Well, let's listen to a section, Flower Wild, the author Shane Tivenin, and the reader here, Ingrid Craigie.
I was taken here to Northampton after I shot the Italian. Il Duce, they used to call him. I shot him one morning in Rome, and my bullet took the tip off his nose. I shot him when they were all still mesmerised by him. They'd sit around in the parks and walk the country lanes, idolising images of him. Il Duce, they would say to each other, long live Il Duce. I shot him many years before they shot him, before they lynched him, before they hung his dead body upside down from a street lamp and danced around below in celebration.
Flower Wild there, I think that's the ninth of the 10 story shortlisted stories for this year's RTE Short Story Competition that we've got to Ingrid Craigie reading from reading the words of Shane Tivenin. So to the final story in this roundup of the 10 of them. And again, I think given that we're in a time of commemoration, this will be a story that really gets into the country's recent history. Everything will be recorded by Sean Mackle. Danielle, let me go to you on this one. There are two strands at play here, which is very interesting.
That's right. It moves very fluidly, I think, between different time periods. And I also think the setting of this story works brilliantly. The remoteness of Inishowen providing that geographical isolation that mirrors the main character's psychological isolation. And I also love the things that happen with language in this story. The German that's spoken by the protagonist's grandchild is a really lovely touch as the characters strive towards a shared understanding despite speaking different languages.
Yeah. Beautiful relationship. We talked about as aunt nephew relationships, father son relationships. This is the grandfather granddaughter relationship, beautifully explored. But the clip that I have from the story actually goes back to the earlier part of the story, which is the troubles in Northern Ireland, is where we are with this bit, Madeline.
Yes, and that's what's so chilling and clever about this story, because you've the sweetness of the encounter with the grandchild and the injured bird. But then these flashbacks to this horrifying chapter of the protagonist's life.
Yeah, and that's the section we're about to hear read for us by Laura Ruddy. The words of Sean Mackle from his story, Everything Will Be Recorded.
He is hooded when they drag him through the darkness up the gravel path. In some dank, derelict building he is strapped to a chair. The air carries the musk of animal droppings. He imagines rats scurrying into the shadows. Is this where it happens? Then there is an audible clunk, the slow turning of cogs, a cassette tape unspooling. His voice cracks as he confirms his name.
Everything will be recorded, the story of Sean Mackle, read for us there by Laura Ruddy. So we have heard from the 10 shortlisted stories. Would you like to know who is in third place? Would you like to know who is in second place? Would you like to know who is in first place? You can do after this break. Welcome back to Arena. Yeah, I wanted to do the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire thing going into the break there, but I don't know about you. I can't imagine what it's like for the shortlisted writers at this stage. They've all heard a section of their story here in Arena on this Friday evening. And I think the tension levels here in studio are fairly high as well. Madeline Keane and Vincent Woods here. And I'm sure Danielle McLaughlin down in Cork, there's a little bit of jiggery pokery and a little bit of even nervousness down there, is there, Danielle?
Absolutely.
Good. 4,000 entries into the RTE Short Story Competition. That became 10 on the shortlist, which we've just heard discussed, and we've heard sections from all of the 10 stories. Remember, those 10 stories are available to read on rte.ie/culture. You can listen to a story from the shortlist on air every night from tonight through until Friday the 9th of October. 11:20 p.m. RT Radio 1 as part of Late Did. The third place writer will get €1,000. The second place writer gets €2,000. The winner of the competition gets €3,000. All of the runners up will win €250 each, as well as getting their story broadcast on RTE Radio 1. So there we go. I think it's time. Danielle McLaughlin in Cork. Will you announce for us, Danielle, please, the third placed short story writer?
third place goes to an expertly paced story, written in assured prose and with an eye for just the right detail. Intrigue builds around a mysterious central image as life comes to imitate art in a sinister way, raising thought-provoking questions about language and the ownership of stories. For all these reasons, and with our congratulations, third place goes to The Shape on the Strand by Catherine Duffy.
And Catherine Duffy is on the line. Congratulations to you, Catherine. Translation is something you know all about.
It is indeed, Sean, yes.
Explain that. Explain why.
Up until last year, my day job was as a translator in the translation section at the House of the Oireachtas. And then I also did a number of freelance translation projects, one of which is was very close to the situation in my story, actually.
Ah, right.
I was actually, full disclosure, I was working on the stories of Martin O'Kine, and I took off to Spain to try and, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but it's really rich and exuberant and wonderful, but it's quite a challenge to translate.
Well, listen.
So I went off and I had time on my own, and I could feel the text almost pushing back against me and almost refusing to be translated. So that's where I got the idea for the story.
I thought you were going to tell me for a moment that the hat was belonging to somebody in the Houses of the Oireachtas, and I'm glad to hear that it wasn't. Congratulations to you, Catherine.
And, Thank you. And thanks to all the judges.
Not at all.
And to everyone who organised this. It's a wonderful competition.
All right. So that's The Ship on the Strand and Catherine Duffy, the third place winner. Let us move on then. We need to get to second place now. And Vincent Woods, I do believe it is your job to announce to me the writer and story that gets second prize this evening.
Yes, Sean. Second prize goes to a funny, subversive, disturbing, original story with echoes of Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror. I could see this as a really effective short film. It is daring in what it does. And it's very much a story for our times. Again, we're delighted to congratulate the winner of this second place in the competition. And that is Alan Walsh with Kissing Booth.
And I bet, Alan Walsh, you thought when we spoke to you earlier in the programme, that's me done, they won't come back to me before the end.
I did. I hung up and everything was like, that's it.
That's me finished with. A good story has to have a little surprise at the end, and there's your little surprise. Congratulations to you, Alan. Onwards and upwards, I guess, from here. Is it an encouragement for you? I guess it is.
Massively, yeah. Thanks very much. It's wonderful. It's lovely to be recognised like this, and it's a great part of it. A cool competition
This one. That's great. Kissing Booth by Alan Walsh, the winner of the €2,000 and second place. All right. The time has come. We want the winner of the 2020 RTE short story. We want the name of the story. We want the name of the writer. And we want you, Madeleine Keane, to do the honours for us.
For its beautiful, lyrical reimagining of one of history's forgotten and tragic figures, and for its compelling portrait of insanity, first prize in RTE Radio 1's short story competition is awarded to Shane Tivenin for Flower Wild.
Shane Tivenin, who is on the line right now. Congratulations, first of all, Shane.
Yeah, thanks very much.
How did you come across this particular character, and why did you want to tell her story, Violet Gibson?
Yeah, I came through the music of Lisa O'Neill. I heard her song about Violet Gibson, and on the off chance the character actually existed, I googled it afterwards and realised she was a real person. I'd never heard of her. And after a small bit of research, I was just quite taken aback, and I actually found it difficult to get her out of my mind until I began to write the story. I found it so intriguing. But the main, mainly because of her anonymity, like no one really knows about her.
Yeah, well, you and several others will be part of that anonymity disappearing, hopefully, in coming time. Let's have a listen to a second clip then, short clip from Flower Wild. Once again, the reader here is Ingrid Craigie, the winner of this year's short story competition, Shane Tivenin, and the story Flower Wild.
I came from a family of privilege, and I always had material things, but I was more restricted than I am now. Every part of me was trapped. A prison built out of female skin. My thoughts were not even my own things.
A section there from Flora Wilde, the winner of the 2020 RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Frances McManus, Ingrid Craigie, the reader, Shin Tivenin, the winner, and Flora Wilde, the winning story. By the way, you can hear that story in full tonight. I had to avoid saying that all the way through the programme. That's the one that you'll hear tonight on Late Date, 20 past 11. And I do believe that Cathal Murray has plans to play the Lisa O'Neill song that inspired Shane as well. So that should be very interesting indeed. Congratulations to Shane Tivenin, the winner of this year's RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Frances McManus, and to the runners-up, Alan Walsh and Catherine Duffy, and indeed to all of the shortlisted writers. That is it from our special programme on the RTE Short Story Competition. Thanks to the judges, Vincent Woods and Madeline Keane with me here in Dublin, Daniel McLaughlin in Cork, and to our colleague Sarah Binchy, the producer of the RTE Short Story Competition. I'd also like to thank John Bates and his team for the live version of this, the video version that you, if you have been watching, that they put that together for us. On sound this evening, we had Gar Duffy. Research was by Leah Murphy and Paula Shields. Broadcast coordinator was Janice Murphy. The producer was Keshi. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.